Podcastle, episode 498 for November 28th, 2017. Chasing Flowers by L. Chan. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Flying Castle. As the days are getting darker, we have a darker story for you. But I hope that you'll get something good out of it. Your author today is L. Chan. L. Chan hails from Singapore, where he alternates being walked by his dog and writing speculative fiction after work. His work has appeared in places like Liminal Stories, Metaphoricist Magazine, and Ars Seneca. He tweets occasionally at L. Chan Writes. Today's narrator is our own Julia Pat. Julia is an associate editor here at Podcastle, as well as a writer and teacher from Maryland. Her fiction has appeared in Clark's World, Escape Pod, Luna Station Quarterly, and other places. When she isn't working on stories or terrorizing her composition students, she gardens, does yoga, games, reads as much as she can, and, in the summer, attends an inordinate number of baseball games. Visit juliakpat.com or follow her on Twitter at chidorme for more. And now let's settle into the front row to hear the players play and enjoy the story.
Chasing Flowers by L. Chan. Leanne's world is flat, not just the landscape, which extends as far as the eye can see, horizon to horizon under the rolling twilight flux. Not just the houses, dotting the slate-gray earth and the thundercloud sky. Not just her folded servants, who used to pat around silently with their painted smiles and their unblinking eyes, unfurling from their hiding places to bring her the same dishes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 100 years. Leanne ate regularly for 50 years before she realized that the food tasted of nothing but fire and ashes. Before she realized that she wasn't hungry, and had never been since her death. Not down here, where the sun peeks over the hills at the edge of the land, and she still doesn't know if it's rising or setting, because it's been stuck there for the 100 years since she died. Diu isn't so bad. It's better when you have money, but what isn't? Leanne doesn't get money anymore. Body to bones, bones to dust. Her gravestone pocked by water, bleached by lichen, and scoured clean by the wind. Her brothers and sisters ceased burning offerings for her shortly after her parents died. They'd be down here too somewhere, her entire family. If there was a torture here for those who'd broken their daughter's body in dreams, she hasn't found it yet. Bodies healed, dreams did not, but Leanne never found it in her heart to seek out her kin's suffering. She's been waiting for a long time, not for money or food or even to expunge her hillock of karma. Not for her family, but for someone else. Leanne's been asking around, paying itinerant souls for information, roaming the 18 courts herself when the money ran out, till her flat paper shoes were worn to shreds and the razor grit turned her footprints scarlet. The sky is raining ashes, gray snow, the air is heavy with hope. Once a year the gates are open. Once a year the dead are free for a month and then to return. The gates of DU are of stained wood, darkened by age, lashed together with the sinews of the dead and blasted clean by the screams of sinners. The gatekeepers flank the open portal, tall as houses, thickly muscled. One had the head of an ox, wickedly curved horns and nails of brass. The other had the head of a horse, mane tangled and matted, nostrils flaring and venting steam like a locomotive. Their eyes narrow at Leanne's approach. Not all ghosts get to leave hell, and they can smell a runner a mile off. She's not used to speed, and she no longer has a beating heart or breathing lungs, but she pushes herself anyway. She's through the gates even as the keepers turn. The chase is on. May's world is flat. She's on something. Rhymes with magazine, but has too many Z's and X's to be a real word. She gets it from a friend who buys in bulk over in Johor and peddles it on the right chat groups. The pills suck the spit from her mouth, and she only pees once a day, but they soften the prickles of living in her skin, so she buys them in unlabeled plastic bottles of 100 each. May knows the names of the flowers by heart in more than one language, some alive, some dead. A riot of colors surrounds her, but the pills fade them all to a mushy gray at the edge of her vision. Flowers don't sell well during the Hungry Ghost Festival, so she preps bouquets to die a slow death in the chiller. A flick of her wrist brings the metallic tool down the stalk of a rose, tearing away thorns. She imagines the rose crying a little with the scrape. Rose, rosei, mei gui hua. Thorns give character. You don't pick a rose straight up. Need to look out for those little needles hiding behind leaves and petals. Move your fingers just so that you avoid getting pricked. Not if it's been stripped, though. Then you just go for it. With another flourish, she flays the personality from the rose. She rubs the short buzz cut above her ears, runs a finger down the 5 studs on her left earlobe. An older lady walks by the shop, eyes lingering on May's hair long enough to be on the wrong side of polite. May pegs her for a hydrangea person, just for the rarity and the expense, not the softness of the petals or the gentleness of their hues. The woman meets May's gaze momentarily, averts her eyes, and stalks off. In her world, flowers should be sold by willowy young things, flowing hair and bending at the waist like stalks in the breeze. Not by someone like May, with her bleached blonde hair, fringe over one eyebrow, and sideburns shaved away. In her too tight jeans and her too tight vest under her short, molding her body into the shape she wanted to be seen in. Still, she was more akin to a clod of dirt than the flowers she clipped, twisted, emasculated, neutered, and bundled. So much easier to love a rose without thorns, but what's the point in that? May slips a pair of 10s from the cash register to pay for dinner, adding it to the mental tally that she'd have to replace by the end of the following week or her boss would know. She breathes in the warm soup of the air outside the shopping mall, peppered with the floating ash of the Ghost Festival. She's already sweating, spreading patches under her arms, but she's not going to roll up her sleeves, not when the gauze over her left forearm is still fresh and the cuts haven't scabbed over yet. Always on the back of the forearm, though, too easy to get an intervention if it's on the other side. Not that she doesn't think about it. She thinks about it a lot. There's a lot of time for that in between assembling bouquets and weaving wreaths. She's walking a little faster now, pressing like an icebreaker through some ambulant flows. And then she's running before the pills wear out. The moon hangs low in the sky, so fat and full that it would have pulled a person's shadow long across the grass. Instead, the shadows are cast by strange cool lights that burn orange like tallow flame. Leanne doesn't have the time to take in the shadows, or the lights, or the crowds of people in strange dress gathering around meshed cages or steel drums, doling out sheaves of rectangular paper into crackling fires. Hell money for the dead. The two are never far behind, and they are gaining. She can hear the bellow of ox reaching low into the bass, so low that it rumbles the grit on the road and blows hell money out of the hands of the crowds into little swirling whirlwinds. She can hear the whistling whinny of horse, screaming like a tortured kettle, shrill enough to tease blood from the ears of babes. The two are tireless, but so is she. She has no wants, no aches, no pains, not here back on earth where she darts between the huddled masses. Leanne does this out of habit. The living offer little more resistance to her flight than would spider webs. Just like running through a spider web, the experience was pleasing neither to the runner nor the spider. She spends more time avoiding the hungry dead, those mournful fresh ones who have yet to forget the sensation of hunger, of being clothed, of 1,000 pleasurable things. They throng around the offerings of money and food, reaching out to brush the cheeks of relatives who flinch at the sudden coldness of the breeze. Horse and ox are gaining, and when they do, they will rend her with their nails of iron and brass. They are not so large outside of Diu, the realm of the dead, not as tall as the shop houses that lined the river downtown, but still, they still stand head and shoulders above the tallest of the living and the dead. Even here there are rules, and they send unfortunate shades flying out of their way in their pursuit of Leanne. There's little she can do against their strength, little that she can affect in the living world. The living and the things that belong to them are as ephemeral to the dead as the shadows are to the living. But with the worlds passing close, the dead were walking with the living and offerings were going up to the dead. Leanne steered herself towards one of the mesh cages in the middle of the crowd doling out hell money and other effigies symbolizing food, luxuries like cars or even pale-faced servants. The dead gathered, unseen, hungry for the feast to come, with more streaming in with each passing moment. The keepers were almost upon her, their breathing labored enough to whirl glowing embers into dancing frenzies that look, for a moment, like screaming bodies. Nobody notices. Leanne picks her target carefully, A girl no older than 12, mechanically feeding the fire with a stack of hell money, wearing a timeless open-mouth look of boredom. She sprinted through the girl, who gave a little yelp at the sudden chill. The stack tumbles into the flames, scattering ash and half-burnt hell money. The living shy away, the dead press in, and Leanne slips into the night. May's out of breath and soaked with sweat by the time she gets to the foot of her block of government flats. Her father might be home. The evening shift hasn't started for taxis. He doesn't ask her who she's seeing anymore. Not anyone that will give you grandkids, Dad. Doesn't ask how her day was. Same. Always some young kid arguing about how much roses cost. Like he doesn't know. Roses don't grow here. They've got to be flown in. Dad's probably left for his shift early, needs to keep moving, his back curved by the long hours behind the wheel. If he moves long enough and fast enough, nothing catches him. Not the traffic police, not the arthritis that locks his fingers into claws, not his own daughter. She's not going up, not yet. There was a girl outside her flat a month ago, leaning over the parapet 6 stories up, smoking light menthol cigarettes. May smiled at her. She had long fingers, high cheekbones, and hair to the middle of her back. The girl offered her a smoke. May took it with thanks, retiring to an evening of Mandopop and Warcraft. Not an hour later, the girl took the express route to the ground floor. The only thing the police left behind when they were done was the pile of ashes near May's door and the smear of drying blood on the pavement below. May doesn't much like to be alone at home after that, not in the ghost month. This country is tiny. They stack people like bundles of paper in concrete coffins. There isn't a spot more than 10 meters from the site of someone's death anywhere on the island. No point in going upstairs anyway. There's a guitar below on a rickety stage, a concert for the living and the dead. They've got a traditional opera singer up there on stage. The singer's resplendent in her silken sleeves and her elaborate headdress. Her lips are rose red and her eyes accentuated by lotus pink. The singer's got range to rival Mariah, but owns the stage like a ballerina with her flowing sleeves swirling around her, more intimate than a dance partner. May doesn't understand the words. It's probably Teochew or Hokkien or some other dialect. The crowd's got an average age of 70, rheumy eyes straining at the stage, heads tilted so that the one good ear gets to hear the singing. Despite the dulling of their senses, the crowd leaves the first row empty. Empty save for a young woman May's age, who's watching the show with every bit as much enjoyment as the aged. The woman's clothes are like nothing May has ever seen. A silk blouse with sleeves stretching to the fingertips. Birds frolicking amidst flowers from shoulder to waist in an intricate embroidered swath. Her trousers are of the same material, a shimmering yellow, tapered to fine ankles and feet. May flinches a little when she sees these, the size of a 12-year-old's. Her features, May notes, are as delicate as her clothes. Her eyes, large and constantly wide with surprise, are dark enough to reflect the whole stage. Her lips are rosebud perfect, accentuated by a single vertical dab of lipstick. May wants to reach out and touch those lips, but already she's been staring too long. The woman favors May with a smile, her teeth small and even, just like everything else about her. May crumbles into the hard plastic chair, the thin plywood board underfoot creaks and sags. "You should apologize to the Ama whose lap you just sat on," says the woman, her eyes bright with mirth. May looks around. The row is empty save for the two of them. A little gallows humor, May thinks. There's a time and place for that, outside of the 7th month. That's been drilled into May's head, part of the warp and weft of the hodgepodge of animist traditionalist belief that she'd grown up with. Don't stick your chopsticks vertically into your bowl of rice. Moths at wakes are the spirits of the departed, come to see if enough tears are shed. The woman turns back to the stage. "I used to live here before it was like this," she says, bringing her arm palm up to indicate May's block of flats. "There was nothing but straight-backed trees of silver bark far as the eye could see. Every morning men would gouge lines into the trunk and bleed the trees of their white sap to boil and make rubber. Acres of scars." She brushes May's forearm, and her touch is cold through May's sleeve and the bandages. May relishes the sensation on her fevered skin. The woman's voice is whisper soft, but it's the only thing May hears. Her Mandarin is clipped, elegant. Each word a speck of intent clothed in the nacre of formal language. May introduces herself. She does this slowly, as though she's unsure of who she is, of who she wants to be for this stranger. The stranger smiles at May. She is generous with her smiles. They crinkle her eyes up at the edges and will leave crow's feet there before long. "My name is Leanne, and I love you," she wants to say. "You love me back. You just don't know it yet." May is dressed for the times, but Leanne still sees the young woman that served her family in the old two-story bungalow which once stood not far from the Gatai stage. May's menfolk were rubber tappers, her other kin, washerwomen, and maids. The bungalow had whitewashed walls, louvers of dark wood to let in the cool breeze and the heated calls of jungle birds. It's all gone now, the plantation and the house replaced by things as tall as the mountain in Diu. May is still waiting for her to complete her sentence, but Leanne leaves it dangling. She's still got her hand on May's forearm, fingers sinking through the weave of May's shirt, down past the bandage, feeling a racing pulse under warm skin. If May notices the chill of the hungry ghost, she doesn't say it. One of the Amas arose behind sees Leanne. She sees the others, too, and has since her youth. The old lady has more friends and family dead than alive, and she looks forward to the ghost month like a child awaiting Christmas. She gives Leanne a smile, comprised of more gaps than teeth. The opera singer tells the crowd about love, the living and the dead nod back. Some of the dead are blurred around the edges, old ghosts, so much so that they're starting to fade, but still hungry. Some for food, some for possessions, but ghosts, most of all, hunger to feel again, feeling like Leanne feels right now. She tells May that there's a story to share, and the two of them are followed from the Gatai by the jealous eyes of unquiet spirits. As they walk, Leanne wonders if the rubber trees screamed when they were bled every day. May doesn't quite notice, but Leanne's feet merely brush the tips of the dry grass. Walking is a habit Leanne recently relearned. The dead have no need for it above ground. She tells May about the big house, which was high as the tallest tree in the plantation, of a lonely child that had a friend in the family serving girl. A friend and more besides. The child became a young woman, and, as was custom, her ama arranged for her to meet the son of a family that had sprouted from the same province in China. The young man smelled of sweat, and of sticky black opium, and of sweet rice wine. She was to be his second wife, his first having borne him only daughters. And so the servant girl hatched a plan for the two of them to escape through the plantation, on a night when the moon was full enough to read by. The lonely girl's feet had been bound in strips of linen and silk since her youth, crushing the forming bones so that their form might be more pleasing to the eye. She didn't run very far before the both of them were caught. The servant girl was lashed with canes of young bamboo, supple enough to bend like whips to break the skin. There was a second plan between the pair, a promise for a second meeting when the moon again hung fat over the treetops. The lonely young lady, now waiting for an auspicious day for her own wedding, the servant girl, a blood price paid to her family, her face scarred with hot water and sold to serve opium in the flesh dens by the docks. What then? Asks May, as flecks of smoldering paper drift on the breeze. They promise to meet in secret, if not in flesh, says Leanne, slipping a silken sleeve up to show scars she'd kept for a century. Ghosts appear as they remember themselves to be. Leanne hasn't forgotten that promise, not for 100 years. One's waiting, the other is lost, going round in circles. Leanne reaches through May's sleeve to stroke the row of scars, etched every day, feeling the warmth leach from May's skin as the latest one continues to leak. Do the rubber trees scream when they're cut? Bleeding is the only thing that makes them useful. There's something I need you to see, May. We're going home. Leanne speaks to May, speaks to the servant girl with her warm hands and warm smile, who once laid cool towels on her brow to break a fever, and herbal poultices on her feet to heal shattered bone. She speaks as ghosts speak, past the ears and straight to the soul. There's only a few hours left for Leanne to do this, to bring May back home. May drifts as Leanne whispers to her, leading her on by the arm. The other woman has given up the pretense of walking. She's lightly brushing the tips of the grass, as though carried by the breeze, her connection to May the only thing anchoring her. The air smells of ash, and of cooked dinners, and of diesel fumes from the road. Despite the press of her body on May's arm, Leanne smells of nothing at all. Where are we going? She asks. Leanne tells her. May snorts. Every culture has a story about someone going to hell to save a lover. Orpheus and Eurydice, Ishtar and Ereshkigal. Mulian saves his mother, says Leanne, cutting May off. This isn't one of those stories, is it? In a way, it all depends on where hell really is. May leaves it at that. She's always wanted to be the hero of her own story, but she could almost believe that she was floating with the strange woman she'd known for half an hour and a lifetime. It's getting late, and they have a long way to go, so May flags a taxi for the two of them. The taxi driver says nothing because it's the 7th month, and to acknowledge things is to invite them into your life. One woman got into his taxi, but he sees two in the mirror. He doesn't mind that the woman shorts him $2 when she pays, because he'll put it all in the temple donation box, offering incense to Kuan Yin and sprinkling his seats with blessed water and flower petals. Mei watches the taxi hurry away. The driver's got better places to be. It's cold, cold for the equatorial climate. She doesn't feel it. She's leaning on Lian. The other woman's colder than her, but she doesn't mind at all. There's a crowd here, amidst the headstones of marble and granite, amidst the burned-down joss sticks, and the offerings of food, fruit, rice, and sweets. Some are dressed like Lian, embroidered silk, others in garb befitting the times, even others that Mei couldn't make out, ones that were fuzzy around the edges, their substance bleeding out and fading into the background. She blinks and they're gone, and back again. Mei's drifting between stations. Sometimes the crowd is solid, sometimes the quiet of a graveyard comes to the foreground. The crowd's got a destination. A queue forms. The dead are used to order. She knows, or has known for a while, that Lian herself is dead, but she doesn't care because Lian's got the same lines down her forearms, and she leans in to whisper in May's ear, growing more solid with each passing minute. They're almost to the head of the line, Lian and Mei. Oxhead and Horseface are there, no longer hunters, back to ushering the dead. Between them lies the gate to Diu, the wood the color of a rotted corpse. The wind rushes out from under the earth, glad to be away from the courts of hell, bringing with it the smells of ash, of blood, of pain. It smells like home, and this time it's forever. Ox bars their way with his weapon, a trident twice Lian's height, its shaft as thick as her calf. You've come back. They always do. Better to be full on meals of ash and dust than to be forever hungry up above, he says. He points to Mei with one iron fingernail. The living cannot pass. These are the rules. His voice is the thunder of bison hooves, the rumble of a mudslide. Elsewhere, one of the ghosts in line weeps at the sound. She is not long for this world, Lian points to the specks of blood at Mei's feet, dripping from her sodden sleeves and fingertips. This is not her place, says Horse, lowering his own spear, the spearhead a sinuous wave of a blade, seeming to writhe like a snake. You know this to be true. This was your place, and hers was to live and live again, until the sun refuses to shine or until your karma is gone. We both killed ourselves. She killed herself for you, says Ox. There's something in his dark liquid eyes now, a hint of something human in a visage inured to a millennia of witness torment. So did I. No, did not. You did it for you. The rules are just, he says, and says it softly, even as the steam from his nostrils blows Lian's hair from her face. There are other rules, gatekeepers. I walked the burning plains for her. I climbed mountains of glass, drowned myself to see if she was beneath the deepest lakes of hell. I have her, and I will not let her go. Lian raises herself to her full height and pulls Mei close. If the gathering crowd of ghosts saw a flicker of a palimpsest, of a shadow self pulled in front of Mei's unresisting body, they say nothing. She will be free to pass through the gates in a moment, says Horse. His voice is high, womanish. Remember that she accepted you as you were, then and now. Would you have done the same for her? Lian is taking almost all of Mei's weight now. Mei is doomed to repeat this. Does she scream every morning when she scores lines on her arms? Lian wonders. Do the trees scream when we draw blades down old scars? Lian's pressed in, bound by strips of linen and silk, duty and family, bones squeezed and shattered that she would be pleasingly shaped to her kin and the world. And she's about to do it to someone else. The crowd parts before them as she half-drags Mei away from the dark gate. Birds are waking up, their brains too small to care about the parade of spirits getting ready to welcome the dawn. Ox calls after her. The gates are closing. They do not open for a year. She ignores him. Lian tears strips of cloth from Mei's shirt and ties them around Mei's arms to slow the bleeding. Mei's getting lighter. Soon she'll be no more than smoke to Lian. There will be help outside the graveyard. She'll go as far as it takes. It is not for the dead to roam this world outside of the ghost month, shouts Horse. It is painful and lonely for a hungry ghost. No, it's not. Mei is still smiling, her eyes half closed, face pressed close to Lian's. With her free hand, Lian strokes May's face. She lets Mei down and sets off into her first sunrise in a century.
welcome back. Of this tale, the author had this to say. I first had the idea for Chasing Flowers several years ago. All I knew was that there would be two women, they would be named after flowers, and there would be some tragedy to do with reincarnation. I always knew it would take place around the 7th month of the Hungry Ghost Festival. Some iterations had Oxhead and Horseface take on human form, and others had a much darker ending. This one balanced all of those ideas, and I'm happy it finally found a home after so long a sojourn in the wilderness. I've been struggling with what to say about this story, especially during the holidays, because it's so dark. But let's just get in there. I found it striking not that the women met because of pain, but because of the way they related to each other over it. One in the modern world through self-harm, and the other because of the beauty standards of the time. In other words, harm for oneself, or harm for others' sake. From what I understand of self-harm, it feels like forward motion. It feels like solving a problem by externalizing it, and that misdirection is part of the trap. We create a problem to solve because we don't know how to handle the real one. That's what keeps us on the reincarnation cycle, not as a punishment, but because we still need to figure out how this all works, without illusions, without justifications. Like Lien not seeking out the suffering of those who did this to her. But I figure she's back in the world because she still has something to figure out. Maybe it's that happy medium between what she is and what she was expected to be. My hope is that through story, whether it's Orpheus and Eurydice or the tale you just heard, we can keep expanding the possibilities of who we can be. We'll keep bringing you stories from all over. Let us know on Twitter or on our forums if this tale, or any others, hit you the right way at the right time. But that's enough heavy talk for now. Before we move to the end with all the thank yous, I wanted to make two announcements. First, The Christmas Mummy and Other Carols by Tim Pratt and Heather Shaw will be out this December. And in case you missed it, Podcastle has a shiny, shiny new website. Head over to podcastle.org to see the redesign and check out our other podcasts, Escape Pod, Pseudopod, and Cast of Wonders, while you're over there. On behalf of everyone at Podcastle, our audio engineer Peter Wood, our forum moderator Ossicat, and your editors Jen Albert and Khalida Muhammad Ali, along with all of our slushers, Aidan Doyle, Arun Jiwa, Crystal Claxton, Matt Dovey, Raj Gopal, Eleanor Wood, Stephen Capps, Stephanie Cox, Devin Martin, Laura Gatz, Julia Pat, Hamilton Perez, Naru Sundar, Suyi Davis Okungboa, and me. Thank you so much for letting us share another story with you. We'll be back next week with another tale. I don't have a closing quote, but I do recommend that, if you're interested, check out any writings by Zhuangzi on the subject of usefulness. See you next week.